Now, it is my great honor to introduce a man that I've known for about 20 years who has worked for this industry as its representative in Washington. Now, for most of you, he needs no introduction. The Wall Street Journal has called him the promoter-in-chief of all things ethanol. Some have even called him the Reverend of renewable fuels. I just like to call him my friend. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the president of the Renewable Fuels Association, the Right Reverend, Bob Dineen.
Thank you, Ron. My friends, from this podium 1 year ago, I stood before you and proudly proclaimed, ethanol has arrived. I may never have been more right. 2006 was a seminal year in the ethanol industry's history. Notable as much for the growth in public awareness as for the phenomenal growth in production. In April, for the first time ever, President of the United States addressed a gathering of the Renewable Fuels Association and noted, renewable energy is one of the great stories of recent years and is going to be a bigger story in years to come. President Bush was certainly right. In May, the RFA was invited to open the trading day at NASDAQ, reflecting the growing recognition on Wall Street that ethanol and biodiesel represent growth markets for the future. By June, ethanol had successfully replaced MTBE in virtually every gallon of reformulated gasoline where it was still being used. In October, for the first time, a president and three cabinet secretaries gathered on the same stage to promote a vision for renewable fuels that few could have imagined even a few years ago. At that same event, the president of the American Petroleum Institute reflected upon the oil industry's newfound appreciation for ethanol's octane and gasoline blending quality and noted refiners could now see a day when 10% ethanol was blended into every single gallon of gasoline sold in the country. In November, the three major U.S. automakers met with the president of the United States and pledged to increase their FFV production to 50% of their vehicles by the year 2012. Before the end of the year, ethanol blended gasoline accounted for 46% of the nation's fuel. Ethanol blends are now being sold literally coast to coast and border to border. Throughout 2006, 15 new ethanol biorefineries opened. Construction began on at least 50 more plants, and the industry set new all-time records for ethanol production, sales, and capacity. The U.S. ethanol industry produced a record 4.9 billion gallons of ethanol in 2006, sold more than 5.5 billion gallons, and with new biorefineries opened and expansions completed, closed the year with more than 5.4 billion gallons of capacity. But we're not done yet. As I stand here today, there are 78 plants under construction. Steel in the ground, dirt being moved, welders welding. These plants will add another 6 billion gallons of ethanol production capacity. 3 billion gallons this year alone. As the industry grows, it is expanding beyond the traditional grain belt with plants currently under construction in Washington, Texas, New York, and even right here in Arizona. And as the industry has grown, so too has the industry's footprint on the economy. In 2006, the ethanol increased gross output by $41 billion, supported the creation of more than 163,000 jobs, including 20,000 in the manufacturing sector, put an additional $6.7 billion into the pockets of American consumers, and added $2.7 billion in new tax revenues for the federal government and $2.3 billion in state and local taxes. From such numbers, it is clear the nation's investment in renewable energy is paying off. Indeed, as 2007 dawns upon us, the U.S. ethanol industry can envision a whole new horizon, one filled with promise, but certainly daunting in its scope. The President's 20 and 10 proposal, unveiled during this year's State of the Union speech, suggest as much as 35 billion gallons of alternative fuel will be needed to displace 20% of our nation's petroleum consumption by 2017. The Governor's Ethanol Coalition is promoting an initiative requiring 60 billion gallons of ethanol by 2030. Senator Dick Lugar of Indiana has introduced legislation mandating 100 billion gallons of ethanol. And countless other initiatives have been discussed or introduced, each built upon the premise that this nation's energy, economic, and national security demands significantly greater ethanol and biodiesel production. Americans agree. In a poll conducted by the RFA last month, 85% of voters across the country believe the government needs to do more, to invest more, and to rely more on domestic renewable fuels like ethanol. Americans recognize ethanol's importance to rural America, to creating jobs, and to helping wean our nation from this dangerous dependence on imported oil. Americans are smart enough not to see ethanol as a panacea, for it is clearly not, but they do see it as an important step toward insulating consumers from the volatility of the world oil market and for helping us to become increasingly less dependent on imported oil. We, as an industry, know that we cannot meet these exalted expectations with existing technologies and existing feedstocks. Thus, the new horizon points toward cellulose, toward new, more energy-efficient technologies, toward non-grain feedstocks, and potentially new, as yet undiscovered, renewable energy resources. We will need it all. It would be a mistake, however, to believe that support for this bold new vision is monolithic. It is not. While support for ethanol has grown exponentially over the past several years and now includes such prior critics as Hillary Clinton and John McCain, skeptics of the industry have also grown, and the resistance to increased ethanol use has become louder as the industry has expanded. But that's okay. Even the mightiest eagle cannot soar without resistance from the wind. My friends, there is plenty of wind in Washington. And we must meet that resistance head on if we are to soar to even greater heights. Some of that new resistance is coming from agriculture itself, from agribusinesses worried that the ethanol industry will drive prices of corn too high and impact supplies of corn needed for feed and food markets. I believe strongly in the ability of the American farmer to produce, and I believe corn growers across this country, having received the market signal to grow more corn, will do so. Most analysts expect between 6 and 10 million additional acres of corn planted this year, which implies a crop in excess of 13 billion bushels, most certainly enough to silence the skeptics. I also believe in technology. When I graduated from high school, the average corn yield was approximately 86 bushels per acre. When my son graduated from high school, the average corn yield was about 160 bushels per acre, almost double in a generation. So I believe the seed companies when they predict 300 bushels per acre by 2025. But I also believe in this industry. I know that ethanol companies are increasing production efficiencies every day with new technologies, and they will continue to do so, getting more ethanol out of every single bushel of grain. Look, corn has been undervalued for too long, and ultimately a stronger rural economy, bolstered by increased farm income, will be better for all America. Keep in mind that one of the primary motivations for expanding ethanol production was to give farmers the opportunity to generate more of their income from the marketplace, not the government. And that's exactly what is happening. The U.S. ethanol industry used 1.8 billion bushels of grain last year, 17% of the corn crop, 26% of the sorghum crop, adding more than $4 billion to net farm income. Ethanol today is the single most important value-added market for farmers. The days of cheap corn may indeed be over, but the market will find a new equilibrium, one that is capable of supplying both feed and industrial uses for corn. As ADM CEO Pat Wirtz stated recently, quote, "It is not food or fuel. It is and or it is both." Put simply, in the big picture, we will not meet the growing demand for food in this world unless we also supply the growing demand for energy. As we meet the resistance of the food versus fuel debate with facts and reasonable dialogue, we will indeed continue to soar as an industry. Resistance is also coming from those who mistakenly believe U.S. trade law protects the U.S. ethanol industry from competition and would like to repeal the secondary tariff on ethanol. Nothing could be further from the truth. The U.S. imported more than 600 million gallons of ethanol last year, more than 400 million gallons directly from Brazil. U.S. trade policy is obviously not a barrier to entry. The Congress enacted the secondary tariff as a credit offset because refiners claim a tax incentive for ethanol use whether the product is imported or domestic. U.S. policy simply assures that taxpayers are not forced to subsidize foreign-produced ethanol, and it encourages investment of U.S. dollars here rather than someplace else. It's a policy that makes sense, and it's one that the Congress will likely continue. There is simply no constituency for subsidizing foreign-produced ethanol by exporting the tax incentive. There is a worldwide market for ethanol that's developing. We should be working with other ethanol-producing countries to encourage growth in biofuels across the globe and to rationalize international standards to accommodate increased trade. But no nation should be required to subsidize the ethanol production of another, period. Some resistance is coming from those concerned the industry is growing in ways that undermine farmer ownership and local economies. Certainly, locally and farmer-owned ethanol biorefineries concentrate the economic stimulus from ethanol in very positive ways. Just one 100-million-gallon ethanol plant will generate $406 million in gross output and support 1,600 new jobs. It is without hyperbole or exaggeration that I state ethanol is revitalizing rural communities across this country. In some cases, a new ethanol plant may be the first business to come to that area in a generation. It allows young people to return home after they left for the big city because a more gainful employment opportunity exists in the place they call home. But Wall Street's newfound interest in ethanol need not be viewed with trepidation. It simply allows a teacher in Boston or a miner in West Virginia or an oil worker in Houston to invest in our nation's energy future as easily as a farmer in Iowa. The locally owned farmer co-op model will continue, but other investment models will develop as well, and in the end, the result will be a much stronger rural economy. Resistance may also come from refiners, from your customers, who are concerned about further mandates. We have made great progress over the past several years working with the oil industry, where mutually beneficial solutions could be found. The transition from MTBE to ethanol this past spring went seamlessly, in large part because of the investments in infrastructure we both made and the constructive relationships we have forged together. We have worked together on a range of technical issues, agreeing to a new ASTM sulfate specification and joining in a variety of research projects to better prepare us for the future. It would be a mistake to abandon that relationship now without first determining if we might find common ground again and without giving the marketplace a chance to work. With more than 1 billion gallons of ethanol coming online in the first quarter of this year and with more than 3 billion gallons likely before the end of the year, we will soon know whether the marketplace has truly accepted the use of ethanol, as API and several oil companies have recently inferred, or whether it remains broken and in need of further stimulus. Increasing the RFS is always an option, but it need not be the first option, particularly if the marketplace is driving ethanol demand on its own. At the very least, we should be listening to our customers. For example, they have indicated repeatedly their opposition to state mandates. I understand that concern. I worked hard with some in the oil industry to create a national renewable fuel standard that has as a central principle the flexibility for refiners to utilize renewable fuels in the markets of their choosing. To a certain extent, state mandates chip away at that flexibility. We can achieve our objectives at the state level without relying upon mandates. I would suggest we look closely at the legislation passed in Iowa last year that relies upon incentives that were supported by the refiners as a means of stimulating additional ethanol production and use in the states. The bottom line, we will reach greater heights if we can do so with our customers. But they must be willing to let us fly as well and be as willing to work with us in the future as they have been in the past. Resistance may also come from those who believe the industry no longer needs the support of the federal government, that the cost of the federal tax incentive is too much, and that significant revisions to the existing incentive program should be contemplated. Such sentiment, while well-intentioned, ignores the reality that world energy markets are replete with government involvement. There is no truly free market in energy. It also ignores that the U.S. ethanol program has worked, and it will continue to be necessary to motivate investment in new technologies and in new feedstocks. Recently, USDA chief economist Keith Collins testified that the increased demand for grain used in the production of ethanol reduced federal farm program costs by more than $6 billion last year. Combined with the $2.7 billion in new federal tax revenue attributable to ethanol, U.S. taxpayers realized a 4-to-1 return on their investment in biofuels with the existing program. Like the Eagle, the ethanol industry can meet the resistance to expanded production and continue to soar. But to do so, we will have to stay focused on the horizon, building for the future, pursuing new markets and new technologies with the same drive that has brought us to these heights. By RFA's estimate, the ethanol industry is poised to saturate the blend market for ethanol by 2010. Even with the recent commitments by the auto companies, this implies the industry will have met the demand for 10% ethanol before a meaningful E85 market will have been allowed to develop. Consequently, the industry needs to work with refiners and auto companies to determine the feasibility of higher ethanol blends. There are legitimate technical issues here, but there is a great deal of anecdotal evidence to suggest higher level ethanol blends can be used. We will need empirical data, but we need to work with the auto industry. Ultimately, it could ease the transition to E85 by building ethanol supplies while the number of flexible fueled vehicles increases and the infrastructure for E85 develops. In anticipation of significantly greater volumes of ethanol on the horizon, we must accelerate and enhance our efforts to promote E85 technology. General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler are to be commended for their efforts to date. 6 million FFVs on the road today capable of using E85 is a tremendous accomplishment. But only 1,200 E85 refueling stations available today is inadequate by any measure. The RFA doesn't support mandating E85 infrastructure, but we will need to do a much better job as more FFVs are made available. I commend those companies like Verison, Abengoa, and Chippewa Valley that have worked aggressively with gasoline marketers and auto companies to create innovative E85 programs. But all stakeholders need to do more. The autos need to optimize FFVs to reduce or eliminate the mileage penalty when E85 is used. Refiners need to allow their franchises to bring E85 under the canopy when the market demands it. And ethanol producers need to be prepared to be the blender of E85 if that's what it's going to take to jumpstart this important market. The growing recognition of the threat to the planet arising from our nation's dangerous dependence on petroleum is presenting new policy horizons as well. Political winds in Washington have shifted, and meaningful action on greenhouse gas emissions is now a question of when, not if. Ethanol can play a role here as well. In 2006, the production and use of ethanol reduced greenhouse gas emissions by some 8 million tons. That's the equivalent of taking more than 1.2 million vehicles completely off the road. This industry has a powerful story to tell with respect to global warming. We have to tell it, and we have to lead. I am pleased to announce that the RFA is joining the Chicago Climate Exchange and will be the first energy trade association to be completely carbon neutral before the end of this year. I challenge others in this audience to do the same. I believe in our fuel. I believe in the urgency of expanded renewable fuel use to stem climate change. And I believe we all have a responsibility to think globally, but absolutely to act locally. I also believe that while the industry as it is today has a very favorable carbon footprint, the industry as it will be soon will provide even more benefits. The ethanol industry has made remarkable progress toward commercializing new technologies and feedstocks. Already, the potential of corn fractionization, corn oil extraction, biomass gasification, and methane digesters promise to revolutionize the industry. But I challenge everyone in this room to keep moving forward. We may have arrived, but we cannot stand still. I believe the people in this room will crack the code, allowing us to produce ethanol from cellulose. The RFA is committed to getting the federal government to provide you with the tools you need to finish the task. We will increase federal funding for cellulose R&D. We will get the long-promised loan guarantee program. We will look for other ways to incentivize cellulosic ethanol production. But no amount of federal assistance is a substitute for the inspiration of enthusiastic researchers or the enthusiasm of an inspired marketplace. My friends, the state of the ethanol industry is sound. We have met the nattering nabobs of negativity, and we have soared. We will continue to soar as we meet resistance with confidence and veracity. We continue to be unified, speaking as one voice in support of an expanding marketplace, and we keep our sights clearly focused on the horizon. The great American poet Maya Angelou once noted, "The horizon leans forward, offering you a space to place the new steps of change." Who here in this room is prepared to stand and take those new steps of change? Who is willing to stand and embrace a new vision for biofuels that promises to dramatically reduce our dependence on oil? Who's willing to stand up to the skeptics, firm in the conviction our farmers can produce enough corn to meet the needs of both food and fuel? Who's willing to stand and commit to expanding the market for higher ethanol blends and E85? Who is willing to stand and join the effort to reduce greenhouse gases by improving ethanol technology? Who's willing to stand and say, "I'll be the first to commercialize ethanol from cellulose"? Who's willing to stand with the RFA as we pursue public policies to lead us to the next horizon? Who in this room is willing to stand up and say we can move forward on this agenda? Who in this room is willing to stand up and say, "I will lead"? Stand up, believe in your fuel. We need to stand together. Beautiful. Then, in the words of that other great American poet, Captain Jack Sparrow,
"Bring me that horizon."
Bring us that horizon. We are going to get there. We're going to get there together. This has been a great year. The next year is going to be even better, I promise. Thank you. Thank you for being here.